I call this meeting of the House Finance and Policy Committee to order. We have a quorum present. Representative Zalesnikar, have you had a chance to review the minutes for March 24th, 2025?
Thank you, Chair, and I have reviewed the minutes and I move for their approval.
Representative Zalesnikar moves approval of the minutes for March 24, 25. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 26, 2025 are approved. So members, we have a full agenda today and a lot of people interested in testifying before the committee. We'll be asking all testifiers to keep their remarks to 2 minutes or less. Staff will be running a timer, and you'll need to wrap up promptly once you hear the alarm. If you don't, I will be compelled at some point to interrupt you, and we don't want that. So we will be starting all testimony with those here in person before moving to those testifying remotely. Before we start, I'd like to give a timeline for our hearing today. We'll spend 45 minutes on House File 1011 from Chair Bierman, 25 minutes on House File 1010 from Representative Egbaje, 25 minutes on House File 1913 from Representative Mahmoud, and 10 minutes on House File 862 from Chair Schumacher. So the first bill on the agenda today is House File 1011 from Chair Bierman and Vice Chair Nadeau. Chair Bierman, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
Chair Bierman moves that House File 1011 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Chair Bierman, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I want to start by thanking my co-author and presenter, Rep. Nadeau, who up here with me, and most of you on the committee for signing on to House File 1011. Scope of practice refers to the activities and procedures that a provider or professional with a specific level of education, training, or competency is authorized to engage in as defined by state professional boards, typically with the guidance or instruction from the state legislature, especially when the professionals can't agree. So here we are today. Members, Minnesota currently ranks in the bottom 20% nationwide for optometry scope of practice. House File 1011 will modernize the scope to the overall teaching and training of optometrists. Nothing in this bill is new to optometry. Nothing scary. This bill will put us in alignment with our neighboring states and the rest of the nation. The last revision to the scope of practice for optometry was 22 years ago. I've carried this bill for 7 years. This long-standing impasse dates back over 40 years. Back in the 80s, the question was whether optometrists could administer drops for dilation or drops for pink eye. More recently, in the last decade, optometrists have pursued meaningful discussions with their ophthalmologist colleagues consistently. I've provided a summary of the past negotiations over the past 10 years in regarding to scope of practice. The consistent response of all entreaties to permit optometrists to work to their level of training and education has always been no. Compromises have been made by optometrists repeatedly. This bill before you is a compromise. This bill is more restrictive than the proposal last year. Optometry agreed to include additional restrictions on the types of injections allowed in Minnesota after this bill was heard in the Senate in 2024. Members, today you will hear anecdotes and see images that are disturbing from the ophthalmologists. I ask you to follow the data, not the anecdotes. We can find examples in any healthcare profession of procedures that go wrong, even among ophthalmologists. It is imperative that the legislature make decisions based on the science and data. The scope of practice for optometry has evolved over the past 50 years through continuous education, training, and certification. During this time, ophthalmology has often claimed that expanding optometry's scope would lead to blindness, harm to patients, or death. However, in all 5 decades of scope expansion across the country, no state has reversed or repealed the legislation that guaranteed these expanded duties to doctors of optometry. If expanding scope had negative outcomes, we would see the data. Ophthalmologists would provide it. None has been presented. Today, let's update this scope so patients in Minnesota can fully benefit from 20 years of advancement in eye care from their local optometrist. Now, Madam Chair, I ask Representative Nadeau to provide a few additional comments, please.
Vice Chair Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. I want to thank Representative Bierman for his longstanding commitment to updating this long overdue optometry scope of practice. Minnesota truly is an outlier in optometry care, and this bill moves us forward slightly to the middle of the pack. Other states and 22 optometry schools have updated their optometry scope, teaching these procedures along with administration of medications, and this committee has broadly accepted and supported ensuring that our medical professionals in Minnesota are practicing at their highest level. 48 other states allow optometrists to prescribe oral antivirals without any restrictions. Only 6 states restrict optometrists from treating their patients with oral steroids or oral carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, and this bill limits this to 14 days. While 25 other states permit injections to treat eye conditions, intravitreal injections have never been part of this discussion in Minnesota, and this bill further specifies that retrobulbar, which is done in a surgical setting, and subtenons injections and intravenous injections are not allowed for optometrists to perform. This bill restricts injection for the eyelid only. Post-file 1011 removes some restrictions around injections and medications around oral antivirals and glaucoma. This bill is about access, and it's about eye care. While optometrists and ophthalmologists work shoulder to shoulder every day in practice, the ophthalmologist lobby has been extremely resistant to working together in this building, ignoring the realities that we face today. According to the American Academy of Ophthalmologists, the total ophthalmology supply of doctors is projected to decrease by 12%, while the demand is projected to increase by 24%. Medical professionals respect each other and know the areas where they can work within their scope, and we trust them to do that. This bill increases patient access and moves Minnesota optometrists' scope of practice to the middle of where optometrists can practice across this nation.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. Vice Chair Nadeau. We'll now go to testifiers. And first up is Dr. Tina McCarty, followed by Dr. Bridget Axelson. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello, my name is Tina McCarty, and I am an optometrist here in Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am the Public Policy and Planning Committee Chair for the Minnesota Board of Optometry. I've also been a practicing optometrist for 24 years and a practice owner. I want to make it very clear that the state board's mission is to protect the public through effective licensure and enforcement of the statutes and rules governing the practice of optometry to reasonably ensure a standard of competent and ethical practice. Our state's health licensing boards, appointed by the governor, serve as the state's subject matter experts in their respective fields. These boards are frequently requested to provide decision makers with commentary information that's honest, ethical, and factual in nature to individual legislators and committees. Consequently, the board has elected to address the growing threat to public health posed by an antiquated scope of care that's long overdue for review and modernization. The board believes primary eye care services in Minnesota have reached a critical juncture due to ongoing internal dispute over the desired level of care and accessibility for our citizens. I want to make it very clear that the state board has no hesitation in complete support of House File 1011. Minnesota optometrists are forced to practice outdated optometry, therefore leaving our citizens at a disadvantage for quality access to care. Scope hasn't moved forward, but education, training, and testing have. Patients need and deserve to see the benefit of that. In addition to access, the antiquated scope has created challenges in attracting and retaining high-quality talent to our state, which adds to the public health concern. It's important to note that House File 1011 will improve, but still fall short of the contemporary national standard of care. The State Board's asking for your vote for House File 1011.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Dr. Axelson, followed by Dr. Hinkemeyer. And if you could both come up to the testifying table, speed us up as we move. All right, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bridget Axelson, and I am a practicing optometrist residing in St. Paul. I'm past president of the Minnesota Optometric Association.
Excuse me, could you please move into your mic a little closer?
Yep, thank you. Okay. I'm Bridget Axelson, a practicing optometrist residing in St. Paul and past president of the Minnesota Optometric Association. I'd like to thank Chair Bierman and Chair Backer and all 15 co-authors on this panel. The scope of practice for optometry, as you heard, has not been updated for over 20 years, but the training and medical expertise of newly graduating and currently practicing optometry certainly has evolved. The legislation removed the current restrictions on oral medications and injections as outlined by Representative Nadeau. You will hear that these oral drugs are rarely used and carry significant risk. Doctors of optometry have been managing these risks and these medications for over two decades. These medications are essential in preventing vision loss that can occur over the course of just a few days of delayed care. We clarified the types of injections this year, including restrictions on subtenons, retrobulbar, intravitreal, and intravenous injections. These restrictions were added based on feedback and meetings with stakeholders over the past 2 years, including three in-person meetings with the Academy of Ophthalmology last session. Yet despite our years of negotiations and willingness to compromise, ophthalmology has responded by filing retaliatory amendments and bills that would roll back optometry scope by decades, banning procedures that are already performed in optometry offices across Minnesota today. Instead of moving forward to meet patient needs, these efforts would strip Minnesotans of access to essential eye care and increase emergency room visits. You will likely hear in this testimony concerns about our ability to manage complications, but optometrists routinely handle pre- and post-operative complications daily of surgical care, drawing on years of experience with delicate ocular procedures. This legislation only expands our ability to provide in-office, non-invasive treatments, not surgeries involving operating rooms, outpatient surgery centers, or sedation. Thank you for your time. Please support House File 1011.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, Dr. Hinkemeyer, followed by Dr. Volman. And if you could please come up to the witness table, that would be great. Thanks.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Dr. Stacy Hinkemeyer, an optometrist from Rice and past president of the Minnesota Optometric Association, representing 1,200 licensed optometrists who provide two-thirds of eye care across the state. House File 1011 is about improving access to eye care for Minnesotans. Our optometry laws are over 20 years outdated, limiting care at a time when demand is rising, especially in rural and underserved areas. Even near an ophthalmology clinic, timely care isn't a guarantee due to limited office hours or lack of appointment availability. This bill ensures patients receive the right care at the right time from the right provider. Opponents claim this bill compromises patient safety, yet they offer no studies or data to back their concerns. Instead, you'll likely hear testimony today about misleading derogatory surveys on procedures not even on our bill. Meanwhile, Ophthalmology, the Journal of Ophthalmologists themselves, confirms a severe and growing eye care shortage projected to worsen by 2035. The need is real, and optometrists are ready to help. Let's be clear. Optometry is a doctoral-level profession. After undergrad, optometrists complete 4 years of intensive education, 10,000 hours of training, including ocular health, pharmacology, and systemic disease, plus 2,000 patient encounters before board certification. This includes the skills needed for the procedures in this bill. Saying optometrists aren't qualified because they didn't attend medical school is like saying dentists or podiatrists aren't either. Yet, due to outdated laws, Minnesota struggles to retain its homegrown talent. As an adjunct professor for multiple optometry schools, I see students eager to return home only to choose states where they can fully use their training. This bill is critical to keeping highly skilled doctors in Minnesota. I'll leave you with two final facts. Number one, no state has ever reversed optometry's expanded scope once implemented. And number two, in states where optometrists already do what this bill allows, malpractice rates remain steady, demonstrating safe, high-quality care. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And before we go to the next testifier, I'll just remind us all that props are not allowed when you're doing testimony. So next up, Dr. Volman, followed by Dr. Kosek. And if you could please come up to the table, that would be great. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Dr. David Volman. I'm a comprehensive ophthalmologist who practices in Minneapolis. Madam Chairwoman and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak to the committee today. I'm here as an advocate for patients, for the safety of patients in Minnesota when it comes to eye care. In addition to extended ability to use oral medications, the current bill would expand optometrist authority to include injections directly into eyeballs as well as into the delicate structures surrounding the eyes. In doing so, the bill before you has the potential to expand the scope of Minnesota optometrist practice to include surgery. The handout on page 17 gives the definition of surgery as defined by the American Medical Association. Surgery is performed for the purpose of structurally altering the human body by the incision or destruction of tissues and is part of the practice of medicine. Surgery also is the diagnostic or therapeutic treatment of conditions or disease processes by any instruments causing localized alteration or transposition of live human tissue, which includes lasers, ultrasound, ionizing radiation, scalpels, probes, and needles. In this thoughtfully written, agreed-upon definition of surgery, the word invasive does not appear. Let me be clear. All surgery is invasive. There is no such thing as non-invasive surgery. However, in this section of Minnesota's statute, the term invasive surgery appears and is the only time this phrase appears in the entirety of Minnesota code. Please refer to the search shown on page 27 of your packet. Adding to the confusion, invasive surgery is not defined, leading to a loophole there may be some eye surgeries that are not invasive. With the expanded ability to inject anesthetics into structures like the eyelids, a natural extension would be performance of surgery on the eyelids, which might be designated as, quote, non-invasive. In doing so, House File 1011 will be used by optometrists to perform surgery. If that were not their aim, we could all agree to support our bill to define surgery. I have respect for optometrists and their role in the eye care team. However, surgery is a fundamentally different discipline that requires extensive medical and surgical training. We should not lower the bar for surgical eye care in our state. I urge you to protect patient safety and maintain the current standards by rejecting House File 1011. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Dr. Kosek, followed by Dr. Danielkova. If you could please come forward and state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, Dr. Matthew Kosek. Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is a surgical bill that removes training requirements. I grew up in St. Paul and practiced as an ophthalmologist in Minnesota for 7 years. Like my fellow eye surgeons here, I completed 4 years of medical school, a year-long hospital internship, a 3-year surgical residency in ophthalmology, and every moment of that training was essential. 200 hours of simulated surgery, suturing pig eyes, mastering microscopic techniques, and observing hundreds of procedures before performing my own under an expert supervision. My training experience includes 187 eye injections and 162 eyelid and trauma surgeries, equivalent to training on each member of the full Minnesota House, this committee, and more. Those hundreds of supervised procedures are irreplaceable. The volume matters because mastering straightforward cases isn't the challenge. It's the complex situations and unexpected complications that demand skill. For injections around the eye or eyelid surgeries, precision is critical. A slight error can spread cancer, scar tear drainage systems, paralyzed nerves, or cause blindness. You need the expertise from 3 years of surgical training to manage those risks. Could Minnesota train optometrists to the same standard? Yes. There's already a path. Medical school and residency training are a proven system that ensures competency and safety. Creating a new, less rigorous pathway for optometrists to do injections or eyelid procedures risks lowering that standard and invites yearly debates here in the legislature about each new procedure. Minnesotans deserve the highest level of skill when their vision and facial function are at stake. To which training pathway would you trust your own vision or that of your family members? I urge you to protect patient safety by maintaining our current effective training framework. And I note that both academic medical centers, the University of Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic, the Minnesota Medical Association, and other groups support us as well. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Last testifier in person is Dr. Danielkova. Forgive me if I've mispronounced your name. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to present today. My name is Dr. Natalia Danielkova, and I'm a board-certified ophthalmologist practicing in Mankato, Minnesota. We also serve Blue Earth County, and our service extends to the south border with Iowa and South Dakota. I'm here to advocate for safety of my patients in southwest Minnesota and express strong opposition to House File 1011, which would allow expansion for optometrists' scope of practice to allow them perform injections in and around the eye. These are not simple or low-risk procedures. Injections around the eye can cause serious complications such as accidental puncture or scratch of the eyeball, bleeding, infection, tissue damage, and even permanent vision loss. The vague and broad language of the bill is troubling. While few injection types are excluded, which mostly go in the back of the eye, this bill still permits wide range of injections in high-risk area, in the skin of the soft tissues of the eyelid, but also the front of the eye that is very, very small area that is less than 2 millimeters, sometimes a little bit bigger. And these are really high for complications rate. Allowing optometrists to perform anesthetic injection is especially concerning. This is not a minor action. This is a first step to eye surgery. Once permission is granted to administer local anesthetic, it opens the door to invasive surgical procedures in the future. And this bill sets the dangerous precedent that could shift the delivery of surgical care into untrained hands. The bill could also allow steroid injections as well as cosmetic injections like Botox and fillers. And when performed incorrectly around the eye, these injections can lead to stroke in the eye and permanent blindness. Once optometrists gain the authority to inject, the risk of misdiagnosis of eye and ocular lumps and bumps increase significantly, and I've already seen this firsthand. I've had patients that were referred to me to drain a regular sty that was observed for several years, and the patient actually had an invasive skin cancer. Another patient observed for 2 years came to me for lesion removal, actually had an eyelid lymphoma. And these conditions...
I ask you to please wrap up your testimony.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So these examples show how dangerous it can be when the treatment and diagnosis is conducted without sufficient training. This bill compromises patient safety and weakens the integrity of medical and surgical care of Minnesotans, which I'm worried about my patients, about healthcare of your constituents and your families. And I urge you to vote no for the House File 1011. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll now turn to our testifiers on Zoom. First up is Dr. Atchison. Watch the screen here. If you could unmute yourself, identify yourself for the record, and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm here to tell you a little bit about the status of rural eye care in Minnesota. I practice and live in Moorhead, Minnesota, but also practice in Wadena, Minnesota. And my partners in Fargo-Moorhead and I provide services to the following rural communities in Minnesota: Detroit Lakes, Ada, Purim, Wadena, Fergus Falls, Crookston, Breckenridge, Boston, and Minnowman. And I know there are similar arrangements in all four corners of the state to provide access to care. Over 95% of Minnesotans live within 30 minutes of an ophthalmologist. My partners and I have arranged to share call services to ensure that there is access to an ophthalmologist on call for our local communities 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In addition, we are always willing to add on patients same day in urgent or emergent situations. I just checked my schedule, and my next opening in my clinic for a non-urgent issue is next Tuesday. Minnesota is fortunate that we have more ophthalmologists per capita than the national average. So even though there has been data showing there's a shortage of ophthalmologists in certain parts of the United States, that is not the case in Minnesota. In fact, our workforce in Minnesota for ophthalmology is projected to continue to increase over the next several years. As far as I am aware, living and practicing in rural Minnesota, there is no access to care issue here, as patients are readily able to see myself and my partners. And I also want to emphasize the immense respect and appreciation I have for optometrists. We work together in very collegial manners every day, but we must continue to work together to ensure that our patients receive the right care at the right time with the provider that has the right level of training to meet their needs. And House File 1011 is both unsafe and unnecessary. I understand that legislators are wary of these continued scope bills, but as long as scope expansion continues to threaten patient safety, which we strongly feel that these injections would do, we will continue to stand up for the safety of our patients. I thank you very much for your time and urge you to vote no.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Our last testifier is Dr. Anderson on Zoom. I'm looking to see if he's here. All right. Any members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, member questions and discussion. Chair Becker.
Yeah, thank you. And Chair Bierman, thank you for this bill, and Vice Chair Nadeau. If in a perfect world, what else would you like to see included? You know, what other procedures do you think would be reasonable? I don't know if one of the testifiers would want to come back up, especially for us in Greater Minnesota to provide additional services. What else would you like to see?
Chair Bierman.
Madam Chair, Chair Becker, I don't have anything else that I would pick, but maybe it's a good idea to hear from our testifiers to see if there are anything. Perhaps a couple of the doctors could come up, the optometrists, if there are any other items that, I mean, it's a theoretical question at this point because we're not looking to add to the bill, so let's just listen to them as far as that goes in the rural areas, perhaps. Go ahead.
Thank you for the question.
Madam Chair, I'll have to work through the chair.
Oh, Madam Chair?
Yes, please identify yourself again for the record and proceed.
Dr. Stacy Hinkemeyer. Thank you for the question. We are very satisfied with the bill as it is. However, there is also talk of a as taught and tested, where our Board of Optometry would determine our scope.
Chair Becker.
No follow-up.
Thank you. Representative Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I have some questions for the optometrists. So I think it's good that some of them are there. So the bill's a little confusing because it uses some language that is not familiar to most people about the injections. So I just want to understand what is really being allowed in the bill. I heard during the testimony, I think I heard Representative Nadeau say that the bill restricts injections to the eyelid only. I don't think that's correct. It's pretty clear that there is injection into the eye being allowed here. And I just really want clarification of where are injections being allowed in the bill, and what would you be injecting, and why would you be injecting into the eye itself? And then I have a follow-up question, Madam Chair.
All right. Who would like to take this question?
Go ahead.
The bill would allow injections in tissues around the eye, and there are a variety of treatments specifically designed to treat, say, glaucoma, where there could be, so we added restrictions to not allow any back-of-the-eye injections. There are a couple types of injections that could be done in the front of the eye for something like glaucoma. The second question, I believe, was what would we be treating or injecting? And so primarily medications into the eyelid for anti-inflammatory or for numbing agents.
Chair Liebling.
Well, Madam Chair, well, you know, I know this maybe isn't the setting to go into all of this detail, but that answer is kind of concerning to me because it's not very specific. And what the bill does here, it seems to me, is really open up quite a lot of where injections can be given. And the way the bill is written, you've just eliminated a few places that you can't give injections, and we've been given a document here that kind of shows that leaves a whole lot of places. So the only thing I really heard is that there's some injection for glaucoma that you could be doing into the eye, but other than that, I didn't get a very good response there. The other question I have, though, is we heard a little bit about the training that optometrists have, but we didn't really hear anything about what kind of training optometrists get for doing injections into the eye, and how many of those kinds of injections an optometrist would be doing during that training. Can you give us a much more specific picture of what that training looks like? And I'm talking about into the eye itself, because that's what you're asking for here, in addition to the around the eye.
And who will take this one?
Can take this one.
Okay. Dr. Hinkemeyer.
Thank you. It's Dr. Hinkemeyer. The procedures that we're asking for are trained in optometry schools across the nation. We did put in at Goodwill, we put in some restrictions, some further injection restrictions after previous discussions last session as a concession.
Chair Liebling.
Well, Madam Chair, well, that did not answer my question. I want to know, how many injections does an optometrist do during their training? How many injections? You're asking, and I have to make another comment, Madam Chair. And, you know, I realize this has been a fraught issue, but some of the language I heard during the presentation is very sort of has an edge to it that I think is not at all helpful here. The interest of legislators is to try to figure out what is best for our constituencies, what it works for the people of Minnesota. And frankly, what this group said and that group said and what the fight has been here and there really is kind of irrelevant. And I'd really like to get away from that. You know, whether you did something as a concession, you know, this shouldn't be about the negotiation. This should be about our constituents and whether this is good for access and whether it's good for safety. And the rest of it, I frankly don't care. But, well, fine, you may care, but I don't care, and I don't think we should care. I think this should be about what is good for Minnesotans, nothing else. So please let's stick to that, but please do answer the question. How many eye injections does the average optometrist perform during training? Because that has to do with, are optometrists really qualified to have this opened up in law? That's what I really need to know.
I can attempt to answer that question.
Yes, Dr. Axelson.
Bridget Axelson, yes. Hi. So I don't have an exact number of how many injections. I can tell you that a 2020 study from the University of Washington revealed that ophthalmology training using simulated eyes was very effective at refining these skills. They closely resemble real eyes. These same models are used in optometry schools. And fourth-year optometry students rotate across the country to a variety of clinical sites, many states of which allow these injections, and they have training in those on their fourth-year clinical rotations. I would need to get back to you on the exact number of injections that students perform in school.
Well, before Chair, I go back to you, Chair Liebling, I'm just going to comment that I'm in my third term, and this issue has been on the docket all my time, and it's always an emotional issue, so I would ask everyone to just take a breath and focus on the need at hand, and we'll work on solving the problem. Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you for that comment. I'm just going to make a brief comment to this. I didn't really get a satisfactory answer. I think it's an incredibly important question. Maybe one of the central questions of this whole bill is, are optometrists trained to be able to do what you're asking to do in the bill? And even if some are, when we pass a bill like this, we're allowing every optometrist to do this. And so if a few are and others are not, I think that would call for an adjustment to what the bill is doing, because we want to make sure that people who are allowed to do something with Minnesota patients are properly trained, and that means all of them. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Before we go to the next questioner, just a time check. We have three other bills on the agenda. We had intended for this to be done at 2:45, and we have five people on the question list.
Chair Ryer, I would like Dr. McCarty to come up and maybe speak to that question of, as the board would be the one to really confirm who can practice to what scope.
Of course.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative McCarty, please proceed.
I'm Dr. McCarty. The National Board of Examiners in Optometry has had injectables on their test requirements since 2013. So the optometrists that have been passed at that point have been certified, board certified, to do the injections. Optometrists that had practiced or graduated previous to that point in time will be required to do additional education and testing that would have to satisfy the requirements, which would be under the purview of the board.
Thank you. Next up is Representative Hewitt, followed by Franzen and Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll try to be as fast as I can here, but I do have a lot of questions and concerns. Madam Chair, Chair Bierman, is there a school in Minnesota for this already, or where would the school be, and what university is hosting it?
Chair Bierman.
Madam Chair, Representative Hewitt, there is not a school of optometry in Minnesota.
Okay, Representative Hewitt. Madam Chair, and I'll go quick on this one. This one should be pretty sweet. So does the ophthalmologist, do they report to the Medical Practice Board in Minnesota, or they have their own board that wants to set these standards? I've done a lot of scope work, and that's where I'm getting caught on, is they don't report up to the Board of Practice in Minnesota like the physicians do, or like our PTs do, or our OTs. Do they do the same thing?
I'm sorry, you said ophthalmologist?
No, I'm saying you guys. Sorry.
No, it's no problem.
Dr. McCarty.
The State Board of Optometry does the regulation for the licensees in our state, yes.
Representative Hewitt.
This will be it. So that's where my concern is right there, that even when we had chiropractors try to change their scope, we had orthopods come in and support that. I saw old video to that, and that's where I'm having trouble. I really appreciate the hard work that the chair has put into this and giving the trail of what's been going on, but I'm really having some hard trouble with this because we're legislators. We don't give eye injections. We don't do that. And I say the same thing about people talking about EMTs. I just really have concerns that we have not found peace in the valley on this one, and I can't support it. Because it really, I'm not qualified to support this bill. I need more information, more evidence, and I'm not getting what I have to get. So unfortunately, I am a no vote today.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm looking at, through the NCSL website here, I see that North Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin are all allowed to have injectables. Are you asking for anything different than what North Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin can already do to their scope? Is this above and beyond North Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin?
Chair Bierman.
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, I would have to look at precisely what those are. I mean, optometrists are doing injections in 25 states, and precisely what they're, you know, it is a state-by-state decision. So I can't say precisely what those three are, but you're correct in that they do injections presently. We have optometrists I've spoken to that work in a clinic in Minnesota and across the river in Wisconsin, and over there he does things with injections, and in Minnesota he does not.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Bierman, in October I met with my optometrist at a round table in my district and I heard the same issues from optometrists practicing in Douglas County that have practice or do practice also in bordering states as well. So I think it would make sense for us to at least be on the same wavelength as our bordering states for access of care. I mean, I heard the one testifier saying that there is not an access of care issue in rural Minnesota. However, her spot of rural Minnesota may not reflect the entire state of Minnesota. So thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Representative Bonner.
Sorry, I didn't realize that was, I couldn't hear if that was Bonner. All right, thank you. You know, we have had a lot of issues with this, and I won't go into that too much, but I appreciate what Representative Liebling said about making sure we stick to the facts. And I think one of the things that we have been struggling with here is this idea of training. And, you know, as the daughter of a nurse and growing up next to a pharmacist, you know, our number one thing is do no harm, right? And we are responsible for the people of Minnesota, our constituents. And what I heard about the training here is you said something about that injectables are on a test. Does that mean a piece of paper? Does that mean, because I don't know that that means that somebody's qualified. And then when we ask about whether you have training, I'm confused because, you know, Minnesota statute section 148.575 says that you need 100 hours of study on legend drugs, which is about a 2-week course. And so we're talking about legend drugs. We've studied that for a while, but then we can't get a straight answer on whether there are more extensive training requirements around injections. And there is nothing in this bill that spells out what that looks like. And I also would amplify that I agree that the way the bill is written feels a little bit deceptive in that we're saying we specifically don't allow these types of injections, but what we've essentially done is kick down the door and let pretty much everything else in. And I find that that isn't helpful to legislators when it feels deceptive, to be upfront. And I still don't have an answer on what types of training you have, how much training do they have, and more importantly, I will just leave with this question and leave it here. But if we allow for the, or if, should this bill not include more extensive requirements around what the training looks like for injections? Because I don't see that in the bill. And what would be the appropriate training to ensure that these could be done safely?
Chair Bierman, any comments?
Madam Chair, I'm just going to ask Dr. McCarty to repeat what she did say about the initial training of the optometry school presently and how that affects the doctors in the field.
Dr. McCarty.
Thank you. Representative Bonner, the injectables have been on the National Board of Examiners in Optometry since 2013. So graduates coming from optometry school for the last 11 years have been trained and tested as they come into practice. Optometrists that have graduated before that certification was done by the National Board will require additional training and testing to be able to perform injections. When we've had scope expansion in the past, and it's been a very long time, But when we have had it in the past, the board has stipulated additional training and testing that was required before optometrists could actually perform.
All right. Representative Carroll, and I'm going to ask, we have four questioners left. If you could please be concise.
I had asked to speak at the first, at the beginning. Apparently, it wasn't caught. So I appreciate you bringing this bill. My primary motivation is patient safety. I'm glad to hear some of that being discussed. But like my colleagues, I'm not sure that it's been adequately addressed. So you make a distinction, and I can go into a whole bunch of things, but I'll limit it to just the injectables. So you distinguish between front of the eye, back of the eye. Why one, why not the other?
Dr. McCarty.
Thank you. The front of the eye is safer, easier. The back of the eye takes more skill, more education. There are states that allow the back of the eye, but optometrists have been so disputed over scope expansion that I believe that they're making concessions. The board, I want to make it very clear, has never been involved in scope expansion efforts. The board is for public safety, just as you are concerned. However, this has become a public safety issue because nothing has expanded in decades.
One follow-up, Representative.
I guess I'm blanking out what my follow-up was, but I was wondering if I could invite the ophthalmologist up to respond to that.
Yeah, briefly.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And the question is, why distinguish between the front of the eye and back of the eye injectables?
If you could please identify yourself again for the record and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Amy Maltry. I am the current president of the Minnesota Academy of Eye Physicians and Surgeons, and I've been an ophthalmologist practicing in Minnesota for 10 years.
Could you please move closer to the microphone?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. And both types of injections, really any injection into the eye, requires extensive training and is very delicate. The anterior chamber of the eye is like 0.2 millimeters in volume. These are very, very tiny spaces. And injection or putting a needle in the front of the eye really should only be done for very serious eye problems, to sample fluid, to rule out severe infections like syphilis in the eye and herpes diseases that can cause the retina to essentially melt away. I mean, these are really rare conditions and just really, you know, don't need to be done on a routine basis, should be seen by an ophthalmologist. And whether you inject in the front or the back, both are very risky and challenging.
All right.
My question.
I'm sorry?
I recall what I was going to ask the optometrist. If I may, Madam Chair, just very quickly.
Very, very quickly, and a quick answer to please.
So the question is, have you ever done a back of the eye injection? And if so, or if not, why? And would you be comfortable doing so?
I think we need to acknowledge the fact that back of the eye injections are not in this bill and they are not for discussion. It's not being asked for, and I think interrogating on that measure for that question, I think, is out of order.
I agree, and we're going to keep moving on.
Thank you.
Representative Zalesnikar, followed by Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Bierman, I appreciate your diligence and passion to make sure that you're taking care of constituents across the state of Minnesota, because how I see this is about access to timely care. And when we're looking at patient safety, whether you get an ambulance to respond timeliness does matter. So this is something that, it's interesting to me to listen to this because this is about people who are trained, board-certified optometrists, who we've listened to and have had extensive training. There's nobody graduating that doesn't have an extensive training healthcare is known for return competency. Whether you're a nurse, you're a nursing assistant, certainly an optometrist, not just an ophthalmologist, not just a doctor, all throughout, it's understood in healthcare to have competency return demonstration. I think it's disrespectful to a profession to imply deceptiveness when it's simply stating what they've been trained to within the scope of their degree. Over half the country has been doing this for a significant point of time. Over half the country. And nobody's changed course. And so the fact that Minnesota continues to have this conversation is quite shocking to me. And if we're going to talk about safety, having access is what we want. We want access with people that have been trained within the scope to practice. And the other thing that is in reality is if you're graduating from a college and this you're an optometrist and you've been trained within your scope of practice, and half the country provides that ability to do the whole scope, people are going to decide to not choose Minnesota. Why would we want to set up our graduating students to not want to practice in greater Minnesota? Whether it's Ely, Grand Marais, southern Minnesota, you pick the state, part of the state, west side, east side, south side, it to me doesn't make any sense. It's common sense that we would let people practice within their scope. We're not creating a new scope. So thank you for bringing this bill.
Thank you. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you so much, Chair Bierman, for bringing this bill. Questions in regards to the drugs that can be administered. So I just wanted to know, is there anything special about the drug rules that you brought forward in this bill? And I'm just curious why they're limited in number and how you think that will be, you know, affect patients' access, affordability, and then just how things will be done in practice. Just around the drug piece. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilman, the oral antivirals are for a disease that herpetic eye disease, for instance, is one. Oftentimes, they need to have a little longer-term therapy to keep the disease in check. Also used for shingles. It is a drug that's used and granted. You know, we've been doing it for 20 years with a 10-day window. In other states, there is no timeline. 47 states allow this. So that's one. Other one, the steroids, often for dermatitis, same thing. That is, I believe that one's 43. Other states, carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, used for people that have glaucoma that require treatment beyond eye drops. So these are just sort of the common top ones that they're using. But I'm going to let the good doctor here comment as well on that. If you have anything to add.
Thank you. Honestly, the only reason that those restrictions are in place is because this exact same scenario has played out over and over and over again for decades. That was a compromise that was done years and years ago, mm-hmm. and just being a practicing optometrist myself, we're sick of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you. So, thank you. Thank you so much for that response. Thank you, well, Chair.
Yeah, we really need to cut things off, Representative. Is that okay? You good?
Well, I'm good. I just want to say one thing about this, though. That compromise has also impacted hundreds, if not thousands, of patients over the years, and I'm excited that we can bipartisanly work together to get this over the finish line so we can make things. Imagine having shingles and not being able to have that. It's painful, and it's horrendous. So I'm glad that we are not going to compromise on some of these things anymore. Thank you so much.
And in a bipartisan move, I am going to apologize to two of our members and say we need to move on so that Representative Agbaje can get up here. So Chair Bierman, Vice Chair Nadeau, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I just appreciate having this discussion over this long overdue scope issue. to me, you know, and I agree with Chair Liebling that we should be looking at the health and the overall issues regarding to scope. We have a lot of disputes going on with whether it's PT or athletic trainers and chiropractic. I believe all professionals should be working up to their scope. That is part of the corrective action and the need that we have to have a solid workforce working up to their scope to get the care out to the people that need them in Minnesota. And I appreciate your consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I renew the motion that House File 1011 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Madam Chair.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
I was going to request a roll call.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
A roll call requested. There will be a roll call. Chair Backer.
I said thank you, Madam Chair. We were in the middle of a motion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the motion needs to move forward as it is.
Yep.
So that's advice, Chair. That's advice.
Chair Bierman. Can we proceed with the voice vote or should we go to a roll call?
Voice vote is fine.
I'm sorry?
Voice vote is fine unless people want a roll call. We can roll it.
I move to reconsider the motion to require a roll call. We could have had it done.
What's that?
Madam Chair.
Just do a voice vote. Okay. I will proceed with a voice vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion prevails. House File 1011 is recommended to be placed on the general register.
All right, we are, members, we are on bill number 2. That would be, where are we at? House File 1913. Oh, sorry, I'm sorry. House File 1010, Representative Agbaje. I will welcome Representative Agbaje to the committee, and I move that House File 1010 be referred to the Judiciary and Finance and Civil Law Committee. Representative Agbaje, I understand you have an A1 author's amendment.
Yes.
I'll move the A1 to get it in the shape the author would like to us to consider it. All those in favor of the A1 say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? And the A1 is before us.
Thank you, Chair, and I'll speak to the bill as amended. Most of the amendments are technical on terms, making sure all the terms are uniform, and just clarifying some of the areas. So today I'm presenting House File 1010, which is the Minnesota Certified Midwife Act. It's a bipartisan bill in both chambers establishing a new pathway for midwifery in Minnesota. In the United States and in Minnesota, we have a maternal health crisis causing high levels of maternal morbidity and mortality. We know that there are stark racial disparities, and also across large areas of rural Minnesota, those areas can be considered maternity deserts. According to a March of Dimes report that was conducted in 2023, about 19.5% of our Minnesota counties are considered maternity deserts based on the availability of birthing facilities, maternity care providers, and the percent of uninsured women, and that statistic continues to get worse, unfortunately, and not better. Pregnant women in rural Minnesota must drive further distances for care, and maternal mortality statistics from the Minnesota Department of Health in 2017 and 2018 indicate that 48% of pregnancy-related deaths occur in rural Minnesota, even though that's an area where residents only make up about a fifth of the women giving birth. Maternity deserts in Minnesota are a serious barrier to accessing safe care. The situation will only become more dire as one-third of Minnesota's midwifery workforce is anticipated to retire in the next 5 to 10 years. Expanding entry to midwifery can help to increase access to more maternal health providers and maternal care. The certified midwife licensure is an evidence-based strategy we can implement in Minnesota to expand our midwifery workforce, increase its diversity, and help address maternity care deserts. Certified midwives aren't new to the United States. They have been practicing in 12 other states with this type of certification already. And in certified midwife certification in some states has also been around for at least 30 years. So by establishing a licensure for certified midwives in Minnesota, we will be introducing a new way to become a midwife, one that doesn't require becoming a registered nurse first to grad. And so in order to receive the licensure under this program, you would need to graduate from a certified midwife degree program. That candidate would also have to complete the same science prerequisites, would have to have the same graduate level midwifery education, and pass the same type of certification boards as certified nurse midwives. This bill looks really similar to the scope of practice for certified nurse midwives, but most of the language changes only just reflect that certified midwives are not nurses. The midwifery scope of practice for certified midwives will be but would otherwise be the same as a certified nurse midwife, except for the nursing part. Currently, right now, the University of Minnesota is poised to start a certified midwife program at the University of Minnesota, but they don't want to start that program until we know that there's a licensure program in place, and so that's what this bill seeks to do. I do have a couple of testifiers with me, so they'll speak to other aspects of the bill and other impacts that they anticipate the bill will have. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Agbaje. And we have Mandy Huber up first, please. Please state your name, and good to hear from you.
Thank you. Mandy Huber, nurse midwife. Chair Bierman, Chair Bacher, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of this bill. As I said, my name is Mandy Huber, and I am a certified nurse midwife, and I am on the board of the Minnesota affiliate of the American College of Nurse Midwives. We support, we educate, and we advocate for optimal health outcomes and access to care for all Minnesotans. We are working with the Minnesota Advanced Practice Registered Nurse Coalition to bring this bill forward, and it has been our top legislative priority since the year 2019. Certified nurse midwives, obstetrician gynecologists, and certified professional midwives are partnering on this bill, and together we agree that Minnesota needs more midwives. The certified midwife could be an essential and evidence-based piece of women's health care in Minnesota. Currently, in order to become a certified nurse midwife, a student must first attend a nursing program and become a registered nurse before pursuing graduate midwifery education. On average, certified nurse midwives practice nursing for fewer than 5 years before pursuing graduate midwifery education. With certified midwife licensure, Minnesotans could instead pursue graduate midwifery education directly after completing the necessary components of the undergraduate education, saving themselves and the state valuable time and funds. This would alleviate the strain on registered nurse education programs. Nursing school seats would instead be reserved for the people who would like to serve their communities as nurses. This is a vital consideration given Minnesota's persistent nursing shortage across the state. Support for this initiative is bipartisan in both chambers and also has strong professional and community support. Page 4 of the 2024 March of Dimes Minnesota report, which is in your packets, identifies that Minnesota has adopted 3 out of 4 policies that would improve and sustain maternal and infant health care in Minnesota. Certified midwife licensure is the only policy Minnesota has not achieved yet. Please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Huber. Next, Dr. Siri Fiebiger.
Thank you, Chair.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
I'm Dr. Siri Fiebiger, and I want to thank you, Chair Bierman and Chair Bacher, for allowing us to bring this bill. I represent the Minnesota section of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And House File 1010 is our top legislative priority this year, and it has been the last few years as well, because it will expand access to high-quality maternal care by creating this new pathway for midwifery licensure. Certified midwives meet the very same competencies and certification standards as the highly qualified certified nurse midwives who have specialized training in low-risk pregnancy, vaginal birth, and wellness care. These midwives are well-grounded experts integrating to higher levels of care as needed, and I find that they have made me a better obstetrician as I constantly learn new information from them every year. Expanding midwifery access is a proven cost-effective strategy that improves maternal health outcomes. States that have expanded midwifery access have lowered their cesarean and preterm delivery rates. I'll say that again. States that have lowered, that have expanded their midwifery care have lowered their C-section and preterm delivery rates, and higher, they have higher breastfeeding rates and higher birth weights. A U of M study forecasted that if we expanded midwifery care across the country, it would mean the prevention of 30,000 preterm births and a savings of $4 billion over 10 years. Minnesota urgently needs more maternal care providers, as now one in five counties lacks any provider. And these maternal health deserts align with existing racial health disparities as well. Nationally, 80% of pregnancy-related deaths are preventable, yet the U.S. still has the highest maternal mortality rate among industrialized nations, despite spending more than anyone else does on health care. In Minnesota, women of color, especially our indigenous mothers, face significantly higher risks of pregnancy-related complications and death, regardless of their education or income level. Midwives offer culturally competent, patient-centered care that can help mitigate these disparities. Importantly, House File 1010 does not debate the qualifications of midwives post-training, but it ensures equitable access to midwifery education licensure, creating a vital new pathway to enter this field. We must take action to ensure that all Minnesota mothers receive the care they need and what they deserve. By expanding midwifery licensure, we move toward a future where every mother, regardless of race, location, or background, has access to safe, high-quality maternal care. Thank you again for consideration of House File 1010, and I welcome questions and ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fieberger. Next up, Rebecca Polston. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Rebecca Polston, certified professional midwife and licensed midwife. Thank you, co-chairs Bierman and Bacher, and members of the House Health Finance and Policy Committee. My name is Rebecca Polston, and I am a certified professional midwife and the founder and owner of Roots Community Birth Center, a nationally recognized freestanding birth center located in North Minneapolis, and one of the very few black-owned birth centers in the United States. I am here to testify in support of the Minnesota Certified Midwife Act, House File 1010. As you have heard, Minnesota suffers from among the worst rates of health disparities in the country, including in maternal health. Black women in Minnesota are 2 to 3 times more likely to die in childbirth than white women. And while just 6.4% of Minnesotans are black, we represent 15% of maternal deaths in our state. Maternal mortality and morbidity are also rising overall in the United States and increased sharply during the first year of the pandemic. The majority of these maternal deaths are preventable. At Roots Birth Center, we serve predominantly patients of color, and we are proud that our midwifery care model is nationally recognized for cultural competence, high-quality birth outcomes, and strong patient satisfaction. While working with the communities experiencing the highest disparities in our state, however, owing to the midwifery model generally and the birth center model specifically, Roots is proud of our virtually non-existent preterm birth rate, our success supporting families to full-term healthy pregnancies, regardless of background, is unmatched. We owe our success to the midwifery model of care, and we achieve these outcomes with a population mix of 65% Medicaid clients and 35% commercially insured clients. But to do more, we need more midwives. We believe House File 1010 enacts a common sense policy to improve maternal health outcomes and reduce disparities in our state by removing the barrier to certified midwifery licensure in Minnesota.
This would also help expand access to high-quality, culturally competent midwifery care in our state. Research from other states indicates that the certified midwife licensure leads to greater ethnic and racial diversity in the workforce. I'd like to thank Representative Agbaje for bringing this important legislation forward and urge the members of the committee to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Polson, for your testimony. Next, we have a virtual testifier, Kylie Sari. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, hello, Chair Bierman and Backer and committee members. My name is Kylie Sari. I'm a certified nurse midwife living in Fairmont, Minnesota, way down by the Iowa border. I'm testifying in strong support of the certified midwife bill. Midwifery is a second career for me. I didn't grow up in rural Minnesota, but after moving here and living here for nearly two decades, I knew I wanted to serve my community in this way. I'm familiar with the specific needs of patients in this area, the resources available, and the culture that's so unique to these smaller communities. I began my journey to become a certified nurse midwife in 2016 by attending nursing school, as my previous bachelor's degree was not in nursing. After earning my BSN, I worked as an RN to meet the entry requirements for midwifery school. Once eligible, I enrolled in graduate midwifery school and completed my degree this year. It took me 9 years to complete this process and put me in significant educational debt. After all that, I'm unable to provide maternal and primary health care for my community. Although the local hospital was hiring midwives when I entered midwifery school, by the time I finished, they were not only no longer hiring midwives, they had closed the L&D department altogether, citing lack of providers. Not only does Fairmont no longer have the critical maternal health care access that it needs, but I have to move out of this community to work as a midwife. Many competent providers willing to work in rural Minnesota have a similar situation. This means less and less access to care in greater Minnesota. For my family, my friends, and my neighbors, I want to work here. I want to serve rural Minnesota. If the certified nurse, the certified midwifery licensure was in place, I could have graduated and begun practicing midwifery earlier, 7 years earlier, with all of the required skills, education, and accreditation needed, without having to shoulder the financial and time costs of obtaining a nursing degree first. I would have been able to provide essential primary and women's health care to my community, and perhaps our OB department would have been able to remain open to our residents. Policies like the Certified Midwife Bill that expand healthcare access are not only beneficial for the state, but are desperately needed for providers and patients alike. Every year that we do not pass this legislation is another year lost on this important investment in our communities, especially in greater Minnesota. Please support House File 1010 to license certified midwives. Thank you.
And thank you, Kylie, for your testimony. Any other members of the public wishing to speak to the bill? Seeing none, we will move to member questions for discussion. Representative Liebling.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. And please look around and see if anybody else wants to go first. That'd be fine, too. But maybe my questions will trigger some other questions. But Representative Agbaje, thank you. And we had a conversation about the bill, and I really appreciate it and would like to continue working with you on it because I agree Minnesota needs more midwives, and I love midwives. And I had three children with nurse midwives were involved in their births. So I really, and that was obviously a long time ago. So I really appreciate the folks who do this work. That said, there are some things about the bill that I'm still not comfortable with. And one of them that I'd really like to ask about is it's not clear to me. So what the bill is doing is saying that a person can come in and do the training to be a certified midwife and have exactly the same scope as the certified nurse midwife. So somebody who's been a nurse for however long, went through all of that training, all the clinicals with that, and that somehow that you don't need to do that. So my question is, what do you have to enter into the training? And tell me a little more. Is it a two-year training? What exactly is the period of training, and a little more about what is involved in the training?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Chair. I'll go to Dr. Huber about this.
Very good.
Midwife Huber, sorry.
Ms. Huber.
Thank you. Excellent question, and I'm really excited to explain.
The prerequisites to enter the programs for to be a certified midwife are very similar to those of any health science professional. There's all the undergraduate basic science courses, and typically one might need to pass like a GRE exam, and then they can apply to the midwifery school. Before that, of course, someone must have an undergraduate degree. Our testifier did not have a graduate or an undergraduate degree in nursing, so she went back to school, did the basic sciences, did the health sciences, got prepared, and then applied to midwifery school. When we enter midwifery school, there are many programs that educate nurse midwives and certified midwives in a combined cohort. When they walk through the doors, they may have different backgrounds, but when they leave the institutional doors, their graduate midwifery provider training has been identical.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, a couple things. One is, you didn't tell me how many years it is. I assume, is it 2 years, a two-year program?
The graduate program is 2 or 3 years, depending if you will leave with a master's or a doctorate.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Okay, and I will just make a statement, and then I'll let you all move on. But so I still have some real concern about this. And one of the things I'd like to, and I'm sorry, Representative Agbaji, when we spoke, I had forgotten about this, so I didn't tell you about this. But if you look on page 2, on line 2.22 of the bill, it describes what the practice means. It essentially sets out the scope of practice. So what you have here, it says, certified midwifery practice means managing, diagnosing, and treating women's primary health care, comma. And then it talks about pregnancy, childbirth, et cetera. So to me, this women's primary health care, that's a really big scope. And I know this is probably mirroring the nurse midwife, so, but these are not nurses. They haven't necessarily worked in a healthcare setting before. I just have really a struggle with the idea that somebody can come in with another undergraduate degree in some science courses and be at the same level as a nurse. And then after 2 years, possibly, be sent out, and the scope of practice is extraordinarily large. Now, I know the argument is we'll know our scope and we won't exceed our scope, but we're saying that these are primary health care providers for women. They have full prescribing, and they are independent practitioners. So they can go and set up a shingle and practice independently. Now, I don't know. I agree. We need more people. We have other levels of midwifery in the state. This isn't the only option. I just have some concern about this still, and I hope to continue working with Representative Agbaje on this. This would be very nice to be able to get to something here and get this done, but this bill, as it's written, still for me still is not it. But I'm open to working on it. Hope we can get there. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Any comments, Representative Agbaje, at this?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Liebling. I appreciate the conversations we've had. I know we'll continue to have more of them. I think, you know, there's still time to open up to figure out kind of, you know, where's the best way to strike that balance. So I think we'll continue talking about that as we proceed. So I appreciate that.
Representative Bonner.
I don't know if another testifier had something else they wanted to add, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Agbaje, yes. Okay. You have another comment you'd like to have addressed? Ms. Fiebiger or Dr. Fiebiger?
Dr. Fiebiger, please.
Yes, Dr. Fiebiger. Please proceed.
This is a long-standing debate, Representative Liebling, around the qualifications of anybody providing primary care. And it's specific to my practice, that long-standing conversations with my family medicine colleagues, and that why would I be doing primary care? Because I'm an OBGYN specialist, and yet because women choose to come to see women healthcare providers, it's essential that we have this as our scope of practice, because I don't treat non-pregnant people with hypertension. I don't treat non-pregnant people with diabetes, but I do diagnose it. and then I refer out. And so it's essential that our certified midwives who are experts in women's health care, I sent my family members to midwives, my non-pregnant family members, because they listen well and they refer appropriately. And so that's why this scope of practice is exactly what it is, because we cannot limit the conversations that these midwives will have with the women who choose to see them first, because they know they listen, they take the time, they aren't on a production schedule like those of us in traditional practice are. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Fiebiger, for your comments. Representative Bonner, we have two more bills, and so if you can be succinct, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Actually, I was going to say, I'm just going to condense because I know we're short on time. I just wanted to say thank you for the bill, Representative Igbaje. Obviously, I'm a co-author of this bill. You know I support it. But over the years, I've heard more and more about midwifery and the experiences they go through and folks who are passionate, not necessarily to become nurses, but because they want to be midwives. And I know that creating pathways to make that possible are really valuable. And everyone I have spoken to who has used that pathway, has used midwives in their practice, has been more than pleased and I've never heard one negative comment. So I just want to say thank you for the bill. I appreciate finding some additional pathways to get there.
Closing comments, Representative Agbeje.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. Appreciate your time today. I think I'll just say at the end, we're always looking for ways to increase access to health care for women across the state of Minnesota. Particularly in this space, we know it's a very turbulent and sometimes a traumatic time. I think a lot of people who are seeking to have children see pregnancy as somewhat daunting, but what midwives have been able to do, and along with the rest of the profession, is make that a little bit easier for more people in the state. And so I appreciate your time and consideration and your support in this bill as we continue to work it through as it moves through the committee process.
Thank you, Representative Agbaje. I renew the motion that House File 1010 be, as amended, be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 1010, as amended, is referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Next up, we have House File 1913. Representative Mahmoud, please take your place. And I will move that House File 1913 be before the committee with the intent to lay over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Mahmoud, I understand you have the A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, Chair, I would like to move that amendment, please.
Representative Mahmoud moves the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like us to consider it in. All those in favor of the A1 say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Mahmoud, to your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee. The physician shortage in the United States is becoming an increasing concern, with projections indicating that by 2030, we could face a shortage of 100,000 physicians due to factors like aging population, rising healthcare demand, and a retiring workforce. Minnesota is already feeling the impact, particularly in rural and underserved areas, where there aren't enough doctors to meet the needs of the population. Despite this shortage, the state has a pool of highly skilled, internationally trained physicians who are eager to practice but unable to do so due to current licensing requirements. These experienced doctors have completed medical training abroad and are ready to contribute but are blocked by the system, which forces them to repeat residency. At the same time, U.S. medical school graduates are facing a shortage of residency spots, leaving many new doctors without the training they need. HF 1913 provides a solution. By removing the residency requirement and replacing it with another, under this bill, an experienced physician would be eligible to practice in Minnesota if they meet the following qualifications. They've graduated from a medical school, they've practiced medicine for at least 5 years of the last 10, and have passed all three-step exams demonstrating the necessary medical knowledge. They've practiced for 2 years in a rural or underserved area, under the supervision of a licensed medical doctor. They've obtained multiple letters of recommendation during this time, with regular check-ins from the medical
board to ensure their progress, and they've provided documentation of their competencies similar to the requirements of residents. If these conditions are met, the physician would be granted a full license to practice in Minnesota. This approach offers several key benefits. It will increase the number of doctors available, particularly in rural and underserved areas. It will also diversify the workforce, improving patient outcomes, especially in diverse communities. By tapping into the skills of these physicians who live in Minnesota, we can address the immediate physician shortage. HF 1913 is a win-win solution, allowing internationally trained physicians to contribute to the healthcare system sooner while ensuring new graduates get the training they need without having to compete for residency spots with experienced physicians. With that, I would like to turn it over to testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Mahmoud. I think we will begin with Dr. Alatbi.
Yes.
I believe he's in the room.
Yes.
Oh,
do you hear me?
He is online virtually as well. Okay. Please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Mahmoud Alatbi. I'm licensed physical medicine or rehabilitation physician and also certified spinal cord injury rehab physician at Health Partner Hospital. I moved from Iraq to Minnesota in 2013, and I practiced medicine in Iraq for 7 years. When I came, it took me about 5 to 6 years to get into a residency. And as I'm here to voice my support to the bill, as a physician who practiced abroad and came here and faced the challenges to go back to practice medicine, and also as currently when I look to the health access for the for Minnesotan and also for U.S. population in general, for primary care provider it takes weeks, for subspecialty it takes months to get into a subspecialty clinic. So I believe that that bill will improve and increase the access to health, and also as we faced with during the because some of the practitioners that who practice in the United States, they come from abroad, and as we saw in during the COVID, when there's disruption of bringing some of the physicians from abroad to practice here, that can be a challenge in the future. That can be a challenge in the future. So I think that that bill will help with the health access for the Minnesotan.
Dr. Alatbi, thank you for your testimony. I do not see the other virtual testifiers. So we will go to any other members. Oh, we do have one. Dr. Maluki? Yes. Please be seated and state your name for the committee and proceed with your testimony. Nice to have you here in person. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Azar Maluki. Committee chair and committee members, good afternoon, and thank you for having me today. I'm here to testify in strong support of the bill HF 1913. I'm a physician from Iraq, graduated from the University of Baghdad College of Medicine, and earned my board certification in dermatology from both the Iraq Board and Arab Board of Dermatology. I worked as a clinical dermatologist and university professor at the medical school for almost 15 years before moving with my family to the United States in 2015 and settling in Minnesota. In Minnesota, I joined the University of Minnesota Medical School as a research fellow for 4 years. During that time, I decided to pursue my medical licensing. Actually, it is my second medical licensing here in the U.S. I passed all the USMLE steps on my first attempt, the OET English Proficiency Exam, and acquired the EEC FMG certification. which is a requirement for IMGs and American graduates to go through residency. My family had to rearrange priorities to afford thousands of dollars required for this journey, for the exams, for clinical rotations, residency preparation agencies, and also for two cycles of ERAS applications. After being unmatched for residency in both cycles, I got great support from the IMG Career Guidance and Support Program at the International Institute of Minnesota. And I was then accepted into the Bridge Program in Minnesota in 2024. This was a crucial step towards achieving my dream of becoming a primary care physician in Minnesota. I believe if this bill had been in place years ago, it would have made significant difference in my life and my family's life, allowing me to help patients as a primary care physician sooner. The bill would provide necessary clinical exposure to the U.S. healthcare system, which is a major obstacle for all IMGs. It would also eliminate the long waiting periods of residency, in my case, 10 years now and still counting, especially as the number of unmatched applicants continue to rise yearly due to increasing numbers of physicians graduating and applying for residency. Also, given the physician shortage in the United States, this bill would utilize the clinical knowledge and experience of hundreds of IMGs residing in Minnesota who have already met the ECFMG requirements and are ready to start their medical residencies. This would significantly improve healthcare access for thousands of Minnesotans, particularly in areas where healthcare is mostly needed. Finally, I hope you will strongly support this bill to help immigrant physicians living in Minnesota to achieve their dream to serve the community as licensed physicians. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Maluki, for your testimony. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? Don't see any. Oh. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, sir, and Madam Chair, and everyone in the room for giving me an opportunity. My name is Dr. Mimi Wu.
Maybe sit a little closer to the microphone, please.
My name is Dr. Mimi Wu, and I'm a physician from Burma. And I'm here to support Bill 1913. I came to the United States many, many years ago, joining my parents. I worked as a physician in Burma for several years, and I had to escape the country because it was in chaos, and I came and joined my family here. Then I had the opportunity to go to Uganda to serve as a UN physician, and I served in Uganda for about 5 years, and then I came back to the U.S. I took all the required medical licensure exams, and I am ECFMG certified. However, when I came back, my son was diagnosed with autism, and I could not pursue with the medical in the medical field. Later on, I did try to apply to medical residencies, and all the doors were closed. Even in spite of my experience as the UN physician, everybody came back and said that you don't have a clinical experience in the United States. So that's what happened, and I never got a chance to get into a residency. However, I was lucky enough that I became I was heading a nonprofit organization called New Americans Alliance for Development, where we, similarly to the International Institute of Minnesota, we worked together with International Institute of Minnesota, and we approached the state, and there was a bill that passed in 2015 for IMG bill, but still it is not enough. Why is it not enough? When you look at the applications for residency programs, there are over 50,000 applications, and the positions are 40,000. I'm not making this up. You can look it up through the National Resident Match Program, because there is not enough funding through Medicare. So even if all the residency positions are filled, you will still have shortage. So this bill perfectly fits in bypassing the residency and eliminating the shortage. So thank you so much, and I do wish to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We will move to members' discussion of the bill. Seeing none, we will move to comments from Rep. Mahmoud. Closing comments, please.
Yes. HF 13 offers a practical, forward-thinking solution to Minnesota's physician shortage. By removing barriers and enabling international trained physicians to practice, we can rapidly increase the number of physicians in the state, especially in areas where they are needed most. So thank you, committee, for your time, and please support the bill.
Thank you, Representative Mahmoud. I renew the motion that House File 1913, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. One more bill. We have time. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. House File 862. I'll move the House File 1913 before the... Oh. Thanks. I'll move House File 862 before the committee with the intent to lay it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Schumacher, I understand you have the A2 author's amendment. Would you like to move the amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Representative Schumacher moves the A2 to get the bill in the shape he would like us to consider it. All those in favor to the A2, say aye.
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 All those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Rep. Schumacher, to your bill.
Thank
as
you,
amended.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This bill, in a nutshell, is allowing for or requiring that there be opioid antagonists in the dorms at our colleges and universities across the state. The portions that pertain to the health committee is lines 1.15 through 1.17 is requiring that the training that is done on the campuses be directed from the Department of Health. There was a fiscal note attached to that. The Department of Health estimated that it would be about $10,000 in 2026 and $2,500 in 2027 in order to compile the resources, the videos for the training there. The A2 amendment came out of the Higher Ed Committee. Representative Knorr suggested that we included the tribal colleges in there, and so there's a blank appropriation for that as we move along and do what you can with that. With me today is Emma Gabbert, who is going to testify on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Please proceed, Ms. Gabbert, to state your name and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Chair. My name is Emma Gabbert, and I am student body president at Metro State University, and I am here testifying for this bill as I have experience administering Narcan. It was 2 years ago on the light rail, and a man was suffering from an overdose, and a fellow passenger had Narcan with them, and I was able to administer that and CPR, and the person came back to life. And so now I'm here as an advocate. And just wanted to share, so the student governments across the Minnesota state system are in support of this bill. There have been numerous overdose deaths across the universities, and naloxone is able to save student lives. The leading cause of death of people 18 to 45 is fentanyl overdose, which naloxone reverses. Fentanyl is laced in a lot of drugs nowadays, not just opioids, and so it is crucial that we have naloxone on our campuses, especially in the dorms, where it is most likely to occur. And then finally, just touching base on the opioid epidemic impacting rural and the metro area. In rural areas, it takes much longer for an ambulance or EMS to arrive to that individual, and it is only a matter of minutes between the time of overdose and administering Narcan. It is between like 7 and 10 minutes. And so, yes, this bill is absolutely vital in saving student lives. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Gabbert, for your testimony. Any members of the public wish to speak at this time? Seeing none, we'll go to discussion of the bill. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher, for the bill. I signed on right away. I think a little bit of history behind the bill that's important is Students United is who brought it to my attention. There's students who are going to school at MSUM in Moorhead, and I absolutely love when our students come forward and say this is what they need to feel safe to complete their education. We've also had some deaths on our campus, and that's traumatic. You know, so it's not just saving one person's life, but also the impact of everybody else. As a parent who has a kid off to college, I would want them to have these resources. If I don't know if it's you or another professional maybe in the room, one of the issues that we're having is we have individuals in our community that adamantly say Narcan is addictive. Scientifically, we know that that's not true, but I feel like we need to maybe have that conversation on the record to kind of say back to our community that this is saving lives, and it's saving your students' lives, and our students came to us asking for, you know, resources to save their life. And so if that's you or if there's somebody else that can maybe just clarify for us the addictiveness or non-addictiveness of Narcan.
Ms. Gabbert, can you comment on that?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Yes. Thank you, Rep. Keeler. Naloxone is not an addictive substance whatsoever. We do have our lobbyist from Students United back there, so he could maybe speak on that a little bit more. But no, naloxone is not an addictive substance. It simply has a stronger molecular buildup to the brain receptors, stronger than opioids. And so, yeah, it is not a drug within itself.
Follow up, Representative Keeler.
That's it. I just needed that on the record. I understand that there's another side of the conversation that we don't want to use this as a crutch for higher usage either. So I do think we have to be careful and mindful of educating individuals that that's not what this is intended to be for. But I agree with you. I don't believe that it's addictive, and I think that it's absolutely necessary for our students. Thank you.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. And this is a follow-up to what Rep. Keeler just said. I'm concerned about whether we're creating a moral hazard with providing. I'm all in support of this, but you understand what a moral hazard is? So what you're doing is you're providing this substance that will counteract the drug that they're abusing or using.
Mm-hmm.
And so it saves them. And so what's to prevent them from just going on and on doing the same thing? That's a moral hazard. So I just want to make sure that that's not being created. And I think that's what Rep. Keeler was alluding to.
Ms. Gabbert.
Yes, yes. Thank you, Representative. I will say that when I administered Narcan on a passenger on the light rail, when he came back to life, he was so thankful. And he, you know, decided to go to the hospital, you know, to continue treatment. I would say the people who are suffering from addiction, it is a disease. It is not a choice. And we want, especially on our college campuses, I think a lot of the time students are going through a big life transition, and it's a very stressful period of time. And so we want naloxone to be available in the case that, you know, one night gets, you know, it goes too far, and, you know, make sure that the RAs have access to naloxone, especially because security and EMS cannot get there in time most of the time.
Representative Becker.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Great idea. I like that. Though just one correction. Sometimes when they wake up, mostly they're thankful, but they can also be very upset. I've experienced that. But at the end of the day, we need to side on saving lives, and I like this bill. Thank you, Chair Schumacher.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a great bill. As Representative Becker and I both have experience in Chair Becker. And I both have experience in this space. And actually what we see, and because if you follow up on these cases, the patients do not want to have this happen to them again.
Yes.
It's such a poor experience from getting brought off that high or what happened there that you'll see that this is the start of maybe something new. It's rock bottom. So I really like the bill. I'm going to go on the bill. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schumacher, any closing comments?
I'll just thank the committee for the feedback there. I think that hopefully the Department of Health was listening, and as they put together the materials for the campuses, they can include some of the concerns here to address that. I would just overall say, too, I forgot to mention in my introduction that this bill came as a topic from a constituent, an idea from a constituent who had a personal situation with an overdose and thought that this may be a way to make sense of that. And when his campus said that they weren't able to or willing to do it on their own, he went to the next level, and here we are.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher, for the bill. Very good bill. Appreciate you bringing it forward. I renew the motion that House File 862, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over, and we are adjourned.